Welcome to Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Sorry might be the hardest word, but this week four top bankers said it. Well, sort of. But as one of Gordon Brown's banking buddies is forced to resign, we'll ask whether the demands for apologies have shifted onto the Prime Minister, as David Cameron seems to think.
Why can't the Prime Minister just admit for once that he made an error of judgment? Isn't this a big part of the Prime Minister's problem? I mean, Sir James Crosby's had the decency to resign. Why can't the Prime Minister have the decency to admit he got something wrong?
And as the dole queue stretches to nearly 2 million, we'll be asking exactly which jobs are being axed. And finally, the experts gave their verdict on ecstasy yesterday, but the Home Secretary found it too agonising to swallow. We'll ask whether there is still any political mileage left in the failed war on drugs. Joining me to chew over all this, we have a Premier League of pundits. The Guardian's executive comment editor, Georgina Henry. The leading columnist of the left, Seamus Milne. And one of the few men who saw the credit crunch coming, the economics editor, Larry Elliott. And hello, everybody.
Hello.
Well, they were a long time coming, but when they arrived, the apologies came thick and fast. This week, the Treasury Committee called in the fallen financial masters of the universe to haul them over the coals. Comedian and activist Mark Thomas went along to watch.
The first thing, and you should remember, the amazing thing about this actually is the committee chairman, Joel McPhail, is a bluff, rough Scotsman. And he is just going, right, let's get it over and done with, let's have your first question. You know, are you sorry? And they all, yes, I feel unreserved apology, dreadful things.
Profoundly, and I think I would say unreservedly sorry.
I'm very sorry what's happened at HBOS.
There's a profound and unqualified apology for all of the distress.
What was interesting then was when they were probed on this, that actually what happened? How come that, you know, the acquisition of AMRO by the Royal Bank of Scotland, how come it was worth it? Does that mean you failed? Well, everything seemed to be fine, according to the bankers.
Just caught everyone out and was not possible at the time to envisage.
They were warned, and they ignored those warnings.
OK, well, can I thank you for your time? It's perhaps not assuaged the public.
What does it all mean? I don't know. I don't think the real questions ever came out, and the real questions were, very, very simply, did you know what was going on? Did you really know, as a banker, the size of your operations? Did you understand what was happening? And I don't think they did.
Georgina Henry, do you feel any better now that the guilty men have said sorry?
Well, the effect was slightly ruined by all the advance stories that they've been so brilliantly well-schooled by expensive PR and media training companies to say it. And it just came across as just too organised, didn't it? And, you know, of course it was good that they said it. They said it on the record. There'd been little enough of that in the past. But somehow the effect was ruined by feeling it was just too scripted. And the other thing is, in the end, that, you know, was it really an apology that mattered? Did it? It was an apology for sort of what had happened, but it wasn't any real sense, I didn't feel, having listened to the whole thing, of sort of recognition of their own parts in really what had gone on and taking real responsibility for that.
What it really was an apology for the events. They kept saying that they were apologising for the turn of events.
Exactly, as if they sort of had themselves. Nothing to do with it, yes.
Yeah, they were still in total denial about the fault and the blame and the reasons for this crisis. I mean, these people were culpable. These people actually presided over these banks when they took crazy decisions which should have been foretold. I mean, there was a whistleblower inside HBOS who actually warned them that this stuff was going to happen, and they just ignored him because there was too much money to be made. I mean, you know, if you imagine for a second that this was a pharmaceutical company that had done this, or a food company that had put out these toxic products, these people would not just be appearing before the Treasury Select Committee; they'd be banged up. There's absolutely no question about it. You know, just because they're bankers, they shouldn't actually get away with the fact that they are culpable for one of the greatest, you know, scandals there's been in many, many years.
And you certainly didn't get that feeling when you watched them,
certainly
did you?
Not.
Absolutely not. You felt it was just like slightly out of their control, you know, the world events, the global this, that and the other. And you didn't get a real sense of what they had done to make this happen.
Is that really fair? I mean, the Treasury, all the worthy officials in the Treasury were banking on the boom continuing in terms of planning for the money they were going to get in. The FSA sort of may have raised the occasional concern, but didn't say the whole system was rotten. Why should these men have been different? Why should they have seen what was coming around the corner?
Well, they were given warnings. I mean, the fact was that the HBOS was actually given a warning by someone inside its own organisation that what it was doing was actually not very sensible. The FSA did actually put out warnings. So did the Bank of England. So did the Bank for International Settlements. So did the IMF. I mean, there were plenty of warning signs out there. The fact was that these warning signs were ignored. And if you probe a bit deeper, I went to the World Economic Forum last year. And there was a conversation between some of these guys, and they said, well, actually, we didn't really know what was going on. I mean, we didn't actually understand all these products that were being sold. And some said, well, why were you doing it then? So they said, because we were making loads of money. You know, we were just carried on doing it while we were making money out of it. But you know, that's not a good enough response. The answer to the question is, well, we were doing it because everybody else was doing it, and everybody else was doing it because they thought there was loads of cheap money to be made. It's not a good enough answer when the outcome is that you've actually led to the collapse, not only of individual banks, but virtually the collapse of the entire Western banking system.
Taken back to the comment of, was it Chuck Prince, the guy who said, while the music's playing, we're going to keep dancing? And that, I suppose that was the attitude that seemed to come out.
Absolutely, that was the attitude. And it was, you know, Chuck Prince said that about 3 weeks before the credit crunch started.
when the music stopped
in a very big way, as it hasn't restarted.
And focusing in now for a minute on this HBOS whistleblower, the director of risk. And this is the short circuit, if you like, that's brought everything back to Gordon Brown, Seamus, isn't it? Because James Crosby is the man who's alleged to have sacked this whistleblower. And James Crosby is also the man that Gordon Brown brought in, first of all, to look at identity cards, and second time round to look at mortgages. What is it with Brown and the bankers? He's got quite a few of them, hasn't he?
Well, as the Guardian's editorial said this morning, I thought very well put, you know, he's been had a relationship with the banking elite, which has really been pretty intimate for the last 15 years and throughout the period he was Chancellor. And he's been bringing these characters, including the ones who were giving evidence in the House of Commons this week, in to advise on this and appear on that panel. And of course, they're still there. I mean, Crosby, as you say, was brought in by Brown to be deputy chairman of the FSA. I mean, a completely baffling decision in the light of events and what's been known. But actually, I think what it reflects is a much broader responsibility. Of course, these bankers are responsible for what they've done and the terrible catastrophe they've helped to bring about. But the responsibility goes much more broadly, and it's part of the whole political elite, both in Britain and in the rest of the Western world, who have been part of this whole process and an ideology which has seen the deregulation of markets, not only in finance but throughout the economy, as the way to growth and success. And that ideology has been shown to be deeply, deeply flawed.
Larry, you're a seasoned Brown watcher. I mean, he's had Sir Fred Goodwin, I think, working on the New Deal. One I'd forgotten about until this morning is Derek Wanless, who's the man who advised him on NHS and health rather than anything to do with banking, was also the chairman of risk, no less, at Northern Rock. What is it? Is this a sort of outdated political strategy, triangulation, that sort of thing? Or is it just Gordon's inherent nerdishness? He likes hanging out with men who like numbers.
I'm not absolutely sure. I think it's partly Labour's love affair with big finance in the city, which started really back in the early 1990s. I mean, I think there was this sort of almost, you know, devoted approach towards the city and the, you know, love of everything, the money and the glamour and the sort of the idea that this was the future of the British economy. And I think Brown actually quite liked the idea of getting in people he thought were experts to provide him with, you know, so-called independent reports. Actually, these independent reports were not really independent reports because the people who were called in were given a pretty good idea of the answer that Gordon wanted. And if they did come up with the right answer, then those reports were acted upon, and if they didn't, they gathered dust in the Treasury. I mean, there was the Barker report on planning and housing that was acted upon because it came up with the right answer. There was a Miles report on mortgage finance, which was left mouldering in the Treasury for many years because it didn't come up with the right answer. So generally speaking, you know, so-called experts were brought in from the city in order to produce reports for the government, which the government actually pre-cooked to an extent.
So in that sense, you're saying maybe we didn't need to worry about it. It might look embarrassing now to have all these associates, but they were being told what to do anyway. So,
well, the Treasury would absolutely deny it, but that's certainly the feeling that people had, that these reports were, you know, they had a secretariat of people inside the Treasury. You know, there was quite a lot of hands-on contact between the Chancellor or whoever it was commissioning a report and these experts, and they pretty much knew the answers that they were supposed to come up with.
But that relationship was anyway, you know, formulating and shaping the kind of political decisions or kind of political things that Brown wanted anyway. So you can't separate these things. You can't, I think, you know, the political decisions were shaped and formed by the intimate relationship with finance and the corporate elite.
I mean, George, I think that the problem is whether or not Brown was calling the tune in terms of these bankers. It's pretty hard to dissociate himself now, isn't it?
I think it's really damaging for him. You know, as damaging as the sort of sense that actually the government's chucking everything at this problem, and as yet nothing very much seems to be working. And we had an interesting discussion in morning conference just before we recorded this programme about the growing consensus really on among the commentariat from wherever they are on the political spectrum. I mean, this week you've heard, well, Seamus this morning, Simon Jenkins yesterday, Anatole Kolecki. In the Times this morning, Larry said it. It's right across the spectrum, saying that nationalisation of the banks may now be the only option. And you get the sense that the government is just sort of trying to throw everything at it so it doesn't have to go there. And he's fighting on so many fronts, really, that, you know, finding kind of qualified people to sort of run bits of, you know, his kind of financial policy is perhaps just one of the many things he's got to kind of address, really.
I mean, I wonder whether... the last best hope he's got, because clearly the economy is going to get worse, and we'll talk about that more in a minute, but is if nationalisation's what's required, doesn't that allow Gordon Brown to stay a little bit ahead of the Conservatives in the sense that they'll be even more reluctant to suggest it than him?
Well, is that... What do you think about that? Because, I mean, Larry,
I think that's right. I mean, I think the political option, the opening is there, and it's been there for the government for the last few months. And at the beginning of the crisis, or the most intense phase of the crisis, they did seem to be moving in that direction. But I think there's been a pullback from that in the last couple of months. And that's, you know, part of their political problem. I mean, you can't stand still in such a situation. You've got to move forward. And they clearly need to move. They're going to be pushed towards this decision anyway, and they already have started to be. But they're holding back from it. They're wasting a huge amount of money and time and people's jobs, as we're going to come on to, in that process. And so the bold and politically effective thing to do is to do exactly what you're saying, move ahead of the Tories. Because, of course, the Tories are completely tarred with the same brush. I mean, they were the ones who deregulated the city in the first place, and they were still screaming and shouting last autumn about there must be no concessions to any questioning of the free market. So there's a political opening that can be used, but the government's reluctant to use it.
But they weren't at the wheel when it all really happened, is it? I mean, that's a fairly powerful political argument in the end, isn't it?
It is, but I think, you know, they struggle to convince the British people that they would have done anything different or that they wouldn't have gone further, because they were the people who originated all this. They were the most enthusiastic free marketeers. New Labour were late converts, if you like.
But the polls are so bad for Labour this week. You just feel that they're, you know, the Tories actually don't really have to expand on that much at the moment.
That's true.
Labour is just digging its hole deeper.
Well, the four contrite banking bosses might be out of a job, but they won't be joining the benefit queue just yet. Millions of others, however, will have no other choice. The Guardian's Ashley Seeger gives us the lowdown on this week's dreadful unemployment numbers.
Well, unemployment suffered another nasty rise this month. It's approached just under 2 million, and the rate is increasing by 50 or 60,000 a month on that measure, the broadest measure. On the claimant count, we're seeing 70 or 80,000 a month. These are both heading up by probably a million this year. Lots of people are losing their jobs across the economy as a result of the credit crunch and the housing market meltdown. You're seeing an awful lot of jobs lost in manufacturing because exporters have been clobbered by the weak economy. Hotels, catering, construction, all of these sectors, estate agents have been losing their jobs en masse. You can see that London unemployment is still just about okay, but those figures are distorted because many of the people who work in the city live outside London and commute in every day. So unemployment in the South East is rising quite fast, but it's also rising in the traditional regions that you'd expect, the northeast, northwest, Yorkshire and Humberside and so on. So it's a fairly broad spread, typical recession Britain. We're in the middle of a nasty recession. Unemployment's been rising for a year. We've probably got another 18 months, 2 years of rises. It's not a pretty picture.
Larry, you were an early prophet of doom. Were the increases in unemployment this week quite as bad as you were expecting?
They weren't, actually. I thought that it could be much worse than this. I think that it's been 70,000 or 80,000 for the last 3 months. I actually thought there could be a six-figure number lurking out there, particularly with the Woolworths having gone finally bust last month. So there were 30,000 workers there. So actually, you know, it's a terrible number. 74,000 is a lot of people, but I actually thought it could be slightly worse. But I mean, I don't actually see much sign of that figure getting much better. I think we're in for many, many more months of 60, 70, 80,000. It might bob around a bit, but we are now into heavy job losses in the economy, and that will go on for at least the rest of this year, I think.
Do you think, I mean, Woolworths and the other January post-Christmas kind of shakeout that we saw, is that going to show up a bit later, do you think?
It may well do. I think the benefit offices are actually struggling to keep up with the numbers now, and so it's probably taking a bit of time to process them. Some of those big job losses won't have shown up yet, certainly on the claim account, and the labour force survey measure is in a month behind, so that's only December. So I think we are definitely in the sort of same sort of pattern that we had in the early 1990s and the early 1980s. You can see quite similar sort of trends. Unemployment picks up by 5,000-10,000 in the early stages, then you get 30,000-40,000, and then you get 70,000-80,000 months, and that's what we're into when you get really a real job, you know, a deluge of job losses.
What do you think of Ashley's argument on the clip just there that the South's going to get it just as bad as the North this time? I mean, as a Northerner, I'm a bit sceptical of that. What do you think?
I think the North is getting it really badly, actually. I was in the North a couple of weeks ago and travelled from Liverpool to Hull along the M62, and there's a lot of job losses in traditional manufacturing areas. If you look at the manufacturing data last week, you know, it's the output is falling at a rate not seen since the three-day week in 1974, and output of industry is, you know, back to where it was 15 years ago. So we're seeing a really savage manufacturing downturn. It's part of a global downturn. Everywhere, every country, you're seeing very, very sharp falls in manufacturing output as the sort of global bubble economy starts to deflate rapidly. And so this is quite unusual for the UK in that the job losses are across every sector, every region. I mean, the recession of the early 1980s was very heavily concentrated in traditional manufacturing and in the traditional manufacturing regions. The recession of the late 80s was mainly a sort of housing market recession. This one is everything. And now that's what's so scary about it, is that actually there's no part of the economy that's immune and no part of the country that's immune either.
George, it's true, as Larry says, that manufacturing jobs have been shed in great numbers. But looking at the figures, the proportional drop in business and business services, finance, that kind of thing is just as large. Do you think that's going to give us a sort of different sociology of unemployment compared with the days of Arfidis and Pep?
Well, one of the things that there's been quite a lot of commentary about this last week and before, really, is that women are losing jobs twice the rate of men at the moment. That's what I think the latest TUC figures show. And, you know, that's a sort of less well-documented loss of jobs, I think. I don't know if Larry would agree with that, but there's some sort of evidence, because of sort of employment patterns are different amongst women, that I think that's really significant. And, I mean, Harriet Harman's been strong on that in the Cabinet, talking about the effects of the recession, particularly on women. And I think it's really one to watch, too, about that sort of workforce just disappearing. To do what?
But I just wonder, Seamus, in terms of the politics, I mean, in the past, I think people had hoped that unemployment would galvanise the oppressed, if you like, to stand up and demand for change. But the record's been pretty bad, hasn't it? From the 30s to the 80s, unemployment's gone along with right-wing governments. Do you think if this time it bites on the middle class more than it has done before, that could make the politics very different?
People said that in the early 90s recession as well. But I think, I mean, the latest evidence I've seen is that actually unskilled workers and young people as well as women are disproportionately affected in this recession as well. I think we hear more because the media tends to focus more on professionals and middle class people. I think because they are being affected, and, you know, obviously particularly in finance and other service sectors, that's getting more of a shout. I mean, you're absolutely right. Of course, recessions and crises don't produce in themselves usually shifts to the left. I mean, there's always a tendency for retrenchment, political retrenchment in recessions. But it does open up opportunities, obviously, for people to question the way things are being run. But I mean, you know, Ed Ball said the other day at the weekend, when he was famously quoted for saying this was the worst recession for 100 years, he also
extraordinary.
Said that there was a risk of
totally extraordinary
a risk of a shift to the right. And that's obviously the case. But I mean, I don't think these are things are written in stone. I mean, it depends what happens in politics.
Did he mean to say that?
Apparently he did. I've not heard that he's been misquoted. Apparently it was a script as well. So I don't think he's been misquoted. I think
I've got the quote here. It's the economy is going to define our politics for the next 15 years. I think that this financial crisis is more extreme and more serious than that of the 1930s. And this is going to be the most serious global recession, so not just in Britain, for over 100 years.
Yeah, I think that's an extraordinary thing to say, because there's no, although this is a very tough recession at the moment, it's not in any way as serious yet as the Great Depression of the 1930s. I mean, the Great Depression, 25% of American output went in 4 years and industrial production fell by 50%. I mean, you know, that was an extraordinary, extraordinary downturn, which went on for virtually a decade, you know, on and off.
Ed Bald is a clever man. He knows this.
I don't know why he said that, because the danger is that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think that it's just hands a massive gift to the Tories. I mean, every time they sort of run down the economy now, they can say, "Well, we're not saying anything that Ed Bald hasn't said."
Well, except I mean, he's also trying to emphasise the point that it's a global recession, isn't it? I mean, that's part of the government's political strategy.
But
I think he's right about the financial crisis, clearly. I mean, partly because of the global nature of financial markets and compared with the 1930s. I mean, I think he's right that it is a more serious financial crisis. I mean, the point that Larry's making is obviously also correct. I mean, it's hard to see why he's saying that about real output, but we'll see.
George, just finally, do you think that, I mean, he might be looking over at America, seeing the way that Barack Obama, for now at least, seems to be turning the crisis to his advantage and thinking there's an opportunity for the left here, or do you think he just fluffed up?
You mean Ed Balls?
Mm.
I don't know. I mean, I thought it was interesting. If you remember the kerfuffle that Darling's comments caused last autumn, when he was
60 years
in, yeah, exactly. And in a way, Ed's comments have sort of come and gone this week. I mean, we all sit around thinking it's extraordinary, but it's a sort of sign of where we've got to just in the last 6 months, I think, that actually they didn't resonate more. Is he looking to America? Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, there's some sort of indication that they're less worried about saying some things that they would have been before. But, you know, as we were talking about earlier, they've got the Tories over one shoulder. So they're also thinking about it in the domestic context.
I mean, the other point that he made, which I think is important, is he said this is going to shape the politics for the coming decades and generation. And I think that's clearly correct.
Yeah.
And he's trying to say, you know, this is both an opportunity as well as a huge challenge. And it's an opportunity for the left, but for everyone in politics to, you know, carve out new agendas.
I suppose it might have been an opportunity, or it might just have been a balled up, but we'll leave it there for now. No more dangerous than horse riding. So wrote Professor David Nutt about ecstasy. That would be a controversial view coming from anyone, but coming from the man who heads up the official watchdog on drugs, it was truly explosive. Yesterday, his advisory council told ministers to downgrade ecstasy from Class A to Class B, based on their scientific assessment of the evidence. But the Home Office gave him short shrift. Only last month, the government also ignored the committee by increasing the penalties on cannabis. Larry, you're a magistrate. Do you think for a moment that these policies do any good at all?
No, none whatsoever. I think it's stupid.
So what do you think's going on? Why are they continuing to defy the evidence?
The fact about this is that these scientists looked at 2,000 papers to come up with their conclusion, but the only paper that really matters in this debate is the Daily Mail. That's what this amounts to, which is that the government didn't want the Daily Mail to be splashing headlines saying government downgrades ecstasy and puts children at risk and carry pictures and lurid stories about people who've died from ecstasy. That's what this is all about. It's nothing to do with science. It's nothing to do with anything other than just naked politics and wanting to protect your flank against the right-wing papers.
You're nodding there, George.
Well, it is just a completely ridiculous thing. If you have a professional committee that is there to advise you on such matters and to look at the science and the medical research and all of that, then to just completely ignore them, not once but twice in the last, whatever it is, 6 months, because obviously they didn't downgrade cannabis, as was also advised. I just think, what is the point? And if you're one of the scientists on this committee, why on earth would you turn up for the next meeting?
Think they should just resign?
Well, I mean, I heard Nutt being interviewed the other day on the radio. I also think it's absolutely ridiculous that he can't float interesting theories about risk. I think it's time to have a really grown-up debate about risk. And, OK, I mean, maybe horse riding's not the appropriate analogy, but I thought it was quite an interesting discussion. And to be slapped down in the way he was, and by the way, he wrote that before he was actually the chair of the committee anyway, although I know he was involved. But I just think it just shows a kind of level of sort of, you know, such juvenile kind of politics about drugs. So, which is not to say that, you know, obviously parents and you know, newspapers can feel strongly about this, but I do think that that is the point of having a scientific committee to advise you. It is rigorous science, and if you then just completely overturn it, I see no point in having it.
Georgina and Larry are obviously right about the substance, but there's another side to it, which is that there's, I mean, that the government has a tendency, which started with the independence of the Bank of England interest rate setting at the very beginning of the Blair government, which is to palm off difficult decisions onto specialist committees of one form or another, or advisory
council. Taking
the politics out of politics. And actually, there's something quite undemocratic about that. We've got to a situation now where it's obviously very convenient to be able to blame this or that quango and not be held responsible for things, but actually governments are elected to be held responsible.
So Gordon Brown, if he were here, would be saying, look, I've stood up and done the right thing. I'm putting the people first. I'm not listening to nerds and technocrats.
Well, as Larry said, he's put the Daily Mail first. But that should be an issue of political battle. I mean, it's right to have the scientific evidence, and that's one thing. And then it's right to have the political argument, and democratically elected bodies should take the decision. So, you know, whether it's the right decision is one thing, but then there's also this whole question of trying to palm off politics onto specialists.
You can't have a sort of pick and mix style approach, can you? I mean, if the government is going to say, well, we'll make the decision on ecstasy ourselves because we don't actually like what the technocrats say, then surely last summer it should have been saying to Mervyn King, you're ballsing up the economy by failing to cut interest rates. We're going to take back interest rate policy and do it ourselves. Which would have actually been a much more sensible decision and would have saved quite a lot of people their jobs. And the fact is that the government just does these things on an ad hoc basis when it feels like it. And that's what it's done with this ecstasy decision. That's not, I mean, ecstasy, I'm sure, is a dangerous drug. But, you know, if you're what sort of signals it send out to young people, I think, which is that, you know, ecstasy is as dangerous as cocaine and heroin. I mean, the science doesn't say that. And a lot of the people who take ecstasy, I'm sure, don't feel in any shape or form that what they're doing is as dangerous as taking smack or cocaine. I mean, I think that the government runs a real risk of losing its credibility here by just ignoring the science and also what people know in their everyday lives.
But I mean, just from your experience in the court, though, do you think magistrates, I mean, what's happened as a result of this is that the maximum sentence for someone caught with a bag of tablets that they're selling to their friends or whatever can go to prison for life, and probably that would happen very rarely. Do you think that magistrates and judges have got enough common sense so that these debates can come and go won't make much odds? Or do you think it will really...
Despite what people think, magistrates have quite strict guidelines on what they can and can't do. And so every time somebody comes up with a particular crime they're supposed to have committed, you have a starting point for your sentence. So if it's a Class A drug, then the starting point for that sentence is much, much higher than the starting point for a Class B or a Class C drug. So
it has real consequences.
So it does have real consequences for people. Yes, it does. I mean, magistrates do use their discretion. They may use their discretion, but some of them probably won't. Some of them would just say, well, it's a Class A drug, bang. You know,
George, can I just try one final thought on you? I mean, looking at this whole issue in the way that Brown's handled it, both cannabis and ecstasy, again, if you look across the Atlantic, if you look in Barack Obama's book, The Audacity of Hope, there's no mention of drugs. And I wonder if it seems quite an out-of-date style of politics, quite a sort of 1980s style of politics that Gordon Brown's still playing and the next generation of politicians won't be.
I don't know.
Looking despairing.
Well, I mean, what you're saying really, sort of generational things are kicking. I don't know. I think, I think they're right about the, I think the political debate is so swayed here by particular newspapers on this issue. And I think that sort of politics actually will matter as much to the next government, even with somebody, you know, who's the sort of same age as Barack Obama, if that's the point. I don't think it's going to go away.
Well, from ecstasy, we have now to shift to agony, the agony of having to say goodbye. Political junkies in need of another fix can always grab one at any time at guardian.co.uk/politics. And you can leave your thoughts on today's programme on The Guardian's politics blog. Thanks to all my guests, Georgina Henry, Seamus Milne and Larry Elliott. I'm Tom Clark. We're taking a week off for Parliament's recess next time, but Politics Weekly will be back on the air in a fortnight. Until then, goodbye.